Yeah, but who put my name out of that book? Why?
Proximity. Because you were fairly near to Joliet. For the same reason, when I was in Atlanta, I interviewed some people who were in that area.
Luke Gatling, of course, he passed away.
He died before I was able to meet him. But then, so did Ken Keltner up in New Berlin, Wisconsin, a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
That happened.
Did you guys ever get a hold of Don Gutteridge? He lives up in Kenosha, I'm pretty sure. Don Gutteridge was first base coach of the White Sox. I'm sure he played a career.
Played with the Cardinals.
I'm not sure if it's, he lives in Kenosha or wherever it is, but I know it's up in that area, you know, Lake Geneva area. Mm-hmm.
Well, there are certainly a great number of ballplayers around, and they all have stories that are worth having in some form, either on tape or written down.
I played in an exhibition game in Cooperstown, and I don't quite remember what year it was, 39, 40, or 41.
So when you were with the Phillies?
Yeah, we played the Boston Braves.
Uh-huh. Well, how did you get started in baseball, Mr. Millies? You're from the Chicago area.
The only thing I can tell you, if you got talent, they'll find you. Sure. Here's a guy who had talent. The cover signed you first, didn't they?
Yeah, Bill Prince signed me in 67.
See, in those days, things were a lot different. Scout would sign you right on the dot. And if he wanted to give you any money, all he did was reach in his pocket, and he had a rule about that thing. He'd peel off of his money and give it the rule.
But you played high school ball here, I suppose?
No. Never played junior college either.
Well, then what, we own a semi-pro team, an industrial team?
No, Nissan Pies.
Oh, yeah.
We used to have Logan Squares, Neeson's Pyatts, Mills, which was a novelty company. They played at around Madison and Cicero, northeast corner.
See. Were you always a catcher?
Yeah.
Who signed you, Walt?
Well, you remember Joe Kernan? Scout for the Cubs. He got me to sign with Nashville and Clarence Rowland. Vance Rowland, he was general manager of the Cubs at one time. He had Nashville. Met him in the Palmer House.
Saw you play out there, and then that's what they did?
No, he never saw me play. So he took me to school.
Word of mouth, then? Word of mouth, then? Somebody told him about you, and he took that person's word.
Yeah.
About how old were you?
In those days?
Yes, sir. When you were signed?
Probably about 24.
Huh?
23. My father, you remember Squeak Fuji? His brother Ossie got the fellow at Richmond, Virginia, to send me a contract. In those days, like, the owners were friendlier to one another. They knew one another. Today it's a lot different.
Yeah.
A lot different today. The main thing is money today.
Did the fellow pull out a bankroll and peel something off for you when you signed?
Not a penny.
No. Mm-hmm. Pay for your meal?
For car fare?
I was playing semi-pro ball in 1929 up in Spencer, Iowa. Jack Ryan came in there, and we had a center fielder by the name of Terry Moore. He's from Gary. We were shooting pool. Binks, Binks had a sandwich shop. Binks, his name of the owner. I mean, it was a good old, good sandwich shop. We were shooting pool, and he walked up to Terry Moore, and he said, "I'll give you $100 to sign." I think Jack Ryan was with the Cardinals. Turned around to me and he said, "I'll give you 50. I said, "No, you won't." He gets 100, I get 100. That was it. Never got the 100.
Did Terry Moore get the 100?
Oh, yeah. He got a lot.
That was a lot of money from the Cardinals in those days, wasn't it?
A lot of money anyway, from anybody.
Yeah.
See, then we used to go to Lake Okoboji, one of the blue watered lakes in the world. There's only three, two in the States and one in France. And we'd play a lot of black clubs that come through there.
Was that the Terry Moore who played center field for the Cardinals?
No. Terry Moore from the Cardinals, he was from St. Louis.
Still living in Collinsville, I think, now on the other side of the river.
Well, I was somewhere in there.
Yeah. Well, you eventually did sign then, and were you assigned to a minor league club?
Well, I signed to Waterloo, Iowa.
About Class B or?
C.
C.
That was C then. It was the Mississippi Valley League there, which is now the Midwest League.
Who was your manager there?
At Waterloo? Cletus Dixon. Could run. Couldn't hit a ball past the shortstop, but he could run like him.
Would you sign him with those credentials?
Hey, get him to do something for you, I guess.
He managed there about 5 or 6 years.
In those days, didn't they have the manager was also a player usually? Yeah, that guy maybe was up in years, player manager.
Solid. You remember Pat Patterson, fellow was in Michigan for the Yankees, catcher. Well, I've seen him in his later years, and I signed with him in Rock Island. And I'm on the train, got my baggage up on his baggage. He came over and told me they're going to release him. He was on the train ready to go on a trip. So when I seen him here, he's scouting for the Eagles. I said, "Don't come near me." I said, "You're the guy that released me." He got angry as hell. Didn't matter to me. Still released me. Didn't change things.
Maybe you should tell them how many times you were released before you played in the big leagues.
About 10 times.
Oh.
That's five before times.
You played in the big leagues.
5 times. Well, see, not because I went to the big leagues. Don't misunderstand me. But in those days, it was more difficult to go to the big leagues. Mm-hmm. Today, the big leagues come down to the player.
Yeah.
Yes.
See, and today you have 26 clubs. In those days, you had 16 clubs.
And a lot more players fighting for those few positions because there wasn't professional basketball or football or other sports to attract them,
too. There weren't any jobs, either.
Right.
See?
Well, what was the biggest difference you found between semi-pro ball and playing in a Class C league?
Well, in the first place, it's more organized and your paychecks were on time.
Oh.
You got meal money and the other fellas were like... go in a small town, you'd see a farmer. A lot of farmers would play, you know, in their spare time. They couldn't play, but they played. Yeah.
Did you grow up on the south side or the north side of Chicago?
I'm raised in Cicero.
Uh-huh.
I went to Luther Institute at Lake and Wood, which is... Luther South and Luther North came out of that. The high schools that are there now.
Mm-hmm. Were you a White Sox fan?
No, Cubs. You would mention the White Sox, they'd run you out of the house. It's true.
I
mean,
I was wondering if you saw the 1919-1920 White Sox ever play.
I probably saw him play, but I hadn't seen him play in the World Series.
No, but I wonder if
Cincinnati.
You saw that team of Jackson and Weaver and all the guys.
Yeah, things are different. Excuse me.
How about when you played against Babe Ruth? Didn't something happen there when you played in spring training or something like that? It was an exhibition.
Yeah, spring training 1 year. 1934. There never will be another guy like Ruth. First place, there won't be a hitter like him. If Ruth hit 320 or 330, he had a bad year. Standing room only when Ruth would hit in batting practice. He didn't know a dollar from a dollar. I see him brought some guy up to him and says, the little fellow was blind, and said, well, he used to play so he reached his pocket and gave him a $20 bill. There's a lot of money in those days. Mm-hmm. We'll tell him what he'd earned today.
Well, Marty said that you played against him, is that right?
No, I never played.
Oh.
Well, just in spring. Just in spring. One game in spring.
Yeah, that was his last year with the Yankees, 34.
Braves. The Boston Braves.
Not 30, that was 35.
35?
Well, yeah.
Difference is 1 year right now.
I was going to say, how long were you in the minors then before you were called up in 34?
Well, 27 was my first year in the minors. 27, 28. And then I was released in spring of 29. And then Donnie Bush sent me to Dubuque. The Dubuque Club and the White Sox were friendly. I got to be a free agent, and Joe Kernan, who played second base, I think, 1 year for the White Sox. He recommended me, and Jimmy Hamilton signed me for San Joe, Missouri. I was there 2 years, and I got my release because the ball club owed me some money. I think it was $100. In those days, they wrote the check. Before the ink was dry, they'd say, Tom, you can have this for your release. What would you take?
Money is awfully important then, and still is.
I took the money,
sure.
And I fell down the stairs running to the bank. John Holland was from St. Joe, Missouri. I knew John. I knew his two sisters.
I'm sorry, I don't know the name. John Holland. You'll have to help me out.
General manager of the
college. Oh, yeah. Oh, all right. 40s,
was it?
Well, he was there sometime
in the 60s. He was the GM when I was playing.
Hmm. Quite a guy.
Well, when you left St. Joe, who'd you hook up with then?
Well, in 1934, I went right to Brooklyn.
Oh.
There was three of us.
Tell them about the L-Rides in Brooklyn now. When you were going to those ball games, I remember you telling me this story, where you'd have to get off at the at the stop before or something like that. Yeah. And people would jump you or something. Oh.
There's no place like Brooklyn.
Yeah.
We'd get off two stops before Ebbets Field, and the kids would all be there. I had I just bought a nice gray suit. Real nice. And in those days, you filled a pen with ink. You didn't have ball pen. when you autograph, more and more could come. You had to get away. You had to go report on time. He said, well, that's all. They just took that pen and squirted the ink right on your suit. Because I'm telling you, Brooklyn,
rough neighborhood.
Yeah, we think they're rough today.
Yeah. Just think what they did to the guys who didn't like.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a lot different today. The intensity isn't there. How many guys on the White Sox or Cubs want to beat you? Think about that. They really want to win over you. There's very few. You don't see a pitcher fight the manager to stay in the ballgame, do you? Manager goes out there and is willing to handle the ball, run off the mound. In those days, they wanted to pitch 9 innings. That's when you get paid for that. See?
Right.
Today, see?
How about some of those scraps you got into at the plate? Come on, get and tell these guys. Those are funny stories. They're great stories.
We were playing Charleston, West Virginia, Dayton. I was at Dayton. And Ducky Holmes was the owner and manager. Great guy to play. Little money, but great guy to play. So it was the ninth inning, and their best right-handed hitter was hitting in the bases were loaded, and we were winning 4-3. So he come out to me and he says, there was no rule like, no thanks. There was no rule like, you go out once, that's like a gratis. The second time you either come out or the player comes out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No. Another thing, if you touched the umpire, you were out for the rest of the year. Not one or two games. That's a joke. Be suspended for 1 or 2 games.
Yeah.
Well, they're to go to the beach. You know. So he came out and he said, we got to win this game.
That's right.
Don't worry about it. No, don't doubt about it. Okay. So I got down to give the sign. I took some dirt and threw it on this guy's shoes. He grabbed me, and if he had grabbed my head, he'd have tore it off. he tore the chest protector right on down. Rolled it up and rolled it. Both of us were showing up at the game. Went to the clubhouse, Ducky was laughing. He says, we won the game. I said, that's what you wanted, wasn't it? Yeah. Oh, yeah, you had a lot of company.
Well, that year in Brooklyn was Casey Stengel's first year as a manager. I
don't
believe
know if
that
was his first year as a manager, but he was a manager that year.
It's pretty fresh, at least. I think it was his first year.
Let me tell you what Casey did. I can't... Tommy Thomas was a writer for the Brooklyn Eagle. And another writer, his father was a writer, had been retired, but he had a hearing aid. In those days, they had the hearing aid, you know, you had that box in front of you and they tuned it up and down. So Stengel seen this fellow coming. And he said, now I'm going to pantomime, and you guys get out your pad and make off like you're writing. There's three other writers. So Stengel's saying, and this guy's coming in, he can't hear him. He found out later on what Stengel did. Stengel, he didn't talk to Stengel for 2 weeks. Yeah. Well, he was dandy.
Did you learn anything from him?
When you went to the big leagues, you learned. You have learned. They didn't say do it this way or do it that way. You either did it correctly or you were gone.
You're expected to know.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Who pitched the first games, the games that you caught in Brooklyn?
Dutch Leonard. Used to be in Illinois here. Used to be the, Illinois has got some type of, the state has got some type of athletic program. And he was heading that after he quit. Knuckleball.
Yeah, later went to Washington.
Mm-hmm. They talk about knuckleballs today. I think I caught four of the best. Roger Wolf, Dutch Leonard, John Nigling, who was a barber, but you never heard much, but he had a hell of a knuckle, and Vern Kennedy.
He was the toughest one for Ted Williams, was Nigling. Ted Williams,
I yeah. Played against Ted Williams in Daytona Beach, 1938. He was with Minneapolis. The ball went through his legs. Base hit went through his legs. He walked over, picked up the ball, Donnie Bush was the manager. And he threw the ball over the right field wall. Yeah.
And the manager's reaction was?
Oh, what could it be? guy hitting 400. We probably threw him another ball to throw. Just throw over there.
Give me another one to throw, yeah.
Well, you didn't stay with Brooklyn in 35. Were you back in the minors then?
No. They sold me to... They fired me to Chattanooga. See, I could have been a free agent. But if I was a free agent, I'd probably have been blackballed. Because there weren't that many players around. Everybody knew everybody. Mm-hmm. They kept me in Chicago, the Dodgers did, until April 1st. Imperative that you report to Chattanooga right away. No spring training. The only thing was, you remember Red Ornsby? Umpire?
Yeah.
Well, I used to work out with him at the YMCA around Halsted and Weebo's there? And Sears, 63rd and Halsted. There's a YMCA about two blocks.
Okay.
Red and I used to work out there. See, and then they sold me to, I came back in 36 in spring training. I had broken my leg in 1934. And they took me on a trip. You see, they can always prove what you can do. They can prove what you can do. In other words, if you can't do anything, they proved it. So they took me on a road trip down spring training and they sent me up to pinch hit. They knocked me down. In those days they knocked you down, they had a knockdown sign.
Yeah.
And I got back up there and I made up my mind I was going to hit one back at the pitcher. Hit a line drive at the pitcher and he went down. So they sold me to Washington. But I only had one good year.
36 was a good year.
I shouldn't be bragging.
Well, anybody can brag about it. You're welcome to brag about hitting .312 in 1936.
Yeah.
Good year by anybody's standards.
They called me up in the office, Clark Griffith. He was the owner, general manager. Going to make a home run hitter.
In Griffith Stadium?
406 feet is the left field line.
Yeah.
I rolled up my sleeves. And he said, see those wrists? I said, they're hardly big enough to hold a bat.
that may be the height of optimism or something, or fancifulness, to make a right-hand hitter and go home run in Griffith Stadium.
Well, see, Griffith... those days, a lot of fellas had a little bonus contract written, clause written. You had one guy right here, Sissel. Sissel, shortstop with the White Sox.
Mm-hmm.
He usually gets a $2,500 bonus if he hit 300. Well, he got hit 294 and he wouldn't play him. That's the way they got around things.
Mm-hmm.
You remember Grabner, Harry Grabner?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Comiskey used to give him X amount of dollars to make up the payroll for the year. Whatever he could chisel off, that was his. So you know,
sure.
You know damn well he's going to do it.
Fixed game in that respect.
Yeah.
The old story of players, a pitcher gets a bonus if he wins 20 games, and so you don't start him after he wins 18 or 19.
There's a pitcher by the name of Mailer with the Boston Braves. He won 16 with a bad club. He's holding out and wrote back he wanted to raise. They said, well, we finished last with you, we can finish last without you. That's the way they treated you. You remember Roush, center fielder?
Ed Roush.
They left him to lay out, and he's a hell of a ball player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Joe Stripp hit 315 in 1934. Stengel, of course, Stengel was a great pressman. He knew what to do with the paper, the newspaper. He said, there's a guy, I showed him how to hit the right field, now he hit 315, now he won't play. Joe took a jacket and laid on the trainer's table, says, I got a cold. He won't play. He hit 315. And he was whole, Marty, he was holed out for $7,500. And then he never played another game in the major league, in pro ball. And then there was a fellow by the name of Bird, center fielder for the Yankees. Out of
Sammy
Nashville.
Bird.
Out of Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
He was holding out and he went into golf. And he said that's the worst thing he ever did was help to hold out.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the Yankees would go to work and say you had a hell of a year. They'd send you the same contract or with a cut to beat you to the punch. And Mr. Weiss would always say, well, you get a World Series center in the fall. Yeah, but who wants to wait in the fall? You're starving. You're not eating.
Sure,
now you haven't got any bread. In the fall.
See? The bills are now.
Hmm?
The bills are now. The bills need to be paid
well,
in the spring.
Well, the thing that all the owners that were screwing the players are dead. The new guys, they give it to them. And I'm going to show you two smart moves that the one the baseball made and the other one the government made. Do you remember Marvin Miller?
Mm-hmm.
Great labor lawyer. And I'm a union man, I want you to know that. Because I belong to the operating engineers. I don't keep my dues up anymore because I can't handle it anymore. But he was a labor lawyer. So what did baseball do? They turned around and they hired Miller to negotiate for him, see? That was one smart move. It was a hell of a move. He got them everything that they have today. And the other move was when John F. Kennedy hired, he didn't hire him, he appointed, I forget what the fellow's name was, Cohen, or a Jewish justice.
Arthur Goldberg?
Yeah, that's it.
Arthur Goldberg.
Made him a Supreme Court judge. He's a hell of a union labor lawyer, see? What is he doing? Give you a job, you're on the Supreme Court. He took it. And then he talked him into quitting and taking the job as, in the cabinet, I forget what.
Yeah.
Took him
Secretary of Labor?
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, sure. I think it was labor.
Perfect. A couple of smart moves. You know, made in labor and Secretary of Labor, and at that time the unions were screaming.
I want to know what it was like to catch Bobo Newsom.
Well, Bobo had a head of his own. He threw 178 pitches one day on a Sunday afternoon. He lost 17 pounds. Of course, he put a lot of it on, you know, had a few beers, and you regained it, you know, the water. He didn't have much of a curve, but anytime Bucky Harris looked down the bench, Bobo had his glove. He was ready to go in there. But he was, I wouldn't want to follow him in life. No way.
He was a drinking man, wasn't he?
Not too much.
No?
Newsom won 18 games. I caught 16 of them in 1936. I'll never forget it. Jimmy DeShong won 16, and I caught about 13. But I would go out to Buck, and I'd get him angry. He'd get so angry, he'd throw the ball hard at me and strike the guy out.
Just had to put the glove in the right spot.
What would it take to get him angry?
Oh, different things. He'd want to throw a curveball, and he didn't have much of a curveball. I'd walk out there and I'd say, "You big southern son of a bitch, I'll kick the living crap out of you." He's about, I don't know, maybe 8 inches taller than I was. And then after he was successful, then he'd come over and he said, "Kid, you're all right." And I said, "I'm all right without you coming over and telling me." But let me tell you about Buck. Griff offered him, I think it was around $12,000 after he won 18 games. And that fall, Buck's building a house. Doing a lot of this with himself. So you know, with patch on patch and a hole in the middle of it. So he built the house and he borrowed, about $7,000, $7,500 from Griff on his next year's salary. So he forgot to put in the chimney. So now he wanted I think we're on $2,000 more for go put the chimney in. Okay, now he's got the chimney in, the house is built, now he wants $1,500 more for furniture. So Griffith answered him, $1,500 too. Now, you see, there's a certain day in those days, and I imagine the same thing today, that they have to send you a contract. If they don't send you a contract before, it's like, used to be about 15th of February, whatever, January, February.
February.
He got his contract, $12,000. He went to the press. He says, "Griffin is the cheapest son of a gun he ever met." He advanced all that money. Oh, he's a dandy.
What was his strength as a pitcher?
Fastball. I'll tell you, this is a good story. It probably shouldn't be in here. Earl McNeely, the coach, McDonald, the radio announcer, myself, and I forget who the fourth man was right now. But we went up to Buck's apartment. At that time, if you paid $175 rent, that was high rent. Buck had a nice apartment. But every light was broken. He had a heck of a time. We had to get the lights, don't think. We had to get some lights together because we played Pinochle, see? Arch McDonald, Jimmy DeShong, I think it was. But anyway, Earl McNeely had just bought a nice gray suit. And we sat down, we got the lights figured, and we were playing Pinochle, and everybody laid their coat. You wore coats in that time. You'd be ostracized if you came in there like that. Really, tie. You always had a tie.
Everybody has a tie.
And laid the coats on the couch or the settee, whatever. And Earl says, "I'm going to put mine on top." I said, "I think you should too, because you got a new suit." I said, "That's so." We finally finished about 11:30 or so. And we look over at the coats, and there's a rabbit on top of the coats. Believe me, big white rabbit on top of the coats. Earl McMeany says to Buck, says to Buck's apartment, he said, "Is that rabbit house broken?" Buck said, "Yeah, sure, it's a house broken." He went over, and the rabbit jumped off. It was full of coffee beans, you know what I mean? And Earl started chasing that rabbit. If he caught that rabbit, he'd have killed it. And Buck's wife is in bed. And she's got the door open. The rabbit running there. Earl ran up to the door. They stopped. And he said, "I can't go in there." I said, "Come on, Earl. Let's get the heck out of here." But, geez, that was funny. That was really funny.
Well, that 36 team was a good team. They finished third, I think, in the American League. And
fourth.
I'll bet
fourth?
Yeah, we got $400 and 1 cent for fourth.
And 1 cent, okay.
I had to get the 1 cent.
Yeah. I'll bet that's the highest a Washington team finished in the next 20 years.
Well, I don't know
more.
Well, they won in
33. They won in 33.
Yeah, but I mean...
And Earl Whitehill won either 21 or 23 ball games and lost 4 or 5. And Biff sent him a contract with a $500 cut. How do you like those games? Boy, you should have heard him rave. Holy shit.
It was standard in those days.
Yeah, they didn't play. I belonged to the Dodgers and I didn't know it. What am I going to do? From Dayton, Ohio. See, Dick Siebert, fellows at Minnesota, Johnny McCarthy, first baseman, all three of us went to the big leagues from Class C. Johnny McCarthy got to be a free agent, and the Giants gave him $2,000 a sign. I bet they took 14 x-rays to see how many base hits he had in them and out of them. You know, $2,000. Yeah.
All he had to do was follow Bill Perry. I mean, that wasn't a big assignment at all.
Well, you remember Freddie Lindstrom?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Freddie hit about 352, I think, if you look it up. He hit real well. And McGraw promised him a job when McGraw would retire. Freddie took a $2,500 cut. He never got the job. Bill Terry got the job. Bill Terry walked in the office. I know that because Freddie was finishing up with Brooklyn in 1936, and I used to sit there and talk to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was pretty bitter after that.
He was from Cedars, Chicago boy. I was all class, third baseman. He could hit. Remember Pinky Higgins?
Mm-hmm.
He hit 330, 340, and about 345, 3 years in a row. Tony Max had told him, he said, before you give him a raise, you've got to be established. You've got to establish yourself.
You know, that was still continuing. Al Kaline tells the story of when he led the league in hitting. 1 year, and the next year he didn't lead the league, but he hit about only 352, something like that. And they caught him. He got a contract with a reduced salary. And we're talking about up in the 60s now.
Yeah.
So that tradition continued for a long, long time.
Yeah, they... I thought I had the old man cornered. I really did, down in spring training. I was holding out 37. I surveyed him. I was calling up there and surveyed the room. He had his, like a corner, he had his desk there, and a chair by his desk, and his chair was in the corner. And I thought, hell, I got this guy. I really thought I had it. I said, sit down. Pulled the chair up so he couldn't get out at the corner. We were talking. I said, now, Mr. Griffith. I said, you know I'm worth more than that to you. And he smoked crooked Havana cigars, black. He always had that box under his arm. Picked up the box, put it on his arm,